KPM correlation function.
Thanks, Pedro. Thank you very much for this opportunity. It's such a big effort, and it's a very effective way of supporting these many things that have worked the past years into a bigger context in a consistent way. So the unifying idea behind this lecture is basically sitting in this picture. So you should imagine that we have that we are an experimentalist and we have a magic ball that runs n equals 4 super m wheels. We have an S3. Suppose we live in 5 dimensions so that we have an S3 that we can put in the lab. And now we can probe this ball from the outside. So that's more or less the picture on this side. We have this sphere in the case of time, of course. And now you can probe it from the outside, and the gauge theory gives you something. You put some sources in, and you detect what comes out. And now by the ABS theory correspondence, this magic ball is simulating ABS. So inside this magic ball, you can think that what's happening is that the particles are going inside ABS, interacting in ABS, scattering, and then they come out again to the boundary. So this is the unifying picture of what we're going to do in this lecture. So in particular, I have here the outline. I separated it into three parts. So the first part is going to be more conceptual. So we want to understand how it is possible. What's this magic property of this ball that although the theory is living just on this S3, it's simulating a theory on one higher dimension. It's generating a radial direction. So we want to understand what's really the property of this field theory that's allowing this to happen. So very directly related is the second point of this loop. So once you have this property that you can actually simulate one higher dimension, then you can start to think, let's try to, although this higher dimension is a thing in Earth spacetime, so it's in ABS, in the correspondence, you can start to think, can I prepare states that focus and they are like narrowed packets that focus in a small region so that the interactions are limited to a flat space region of the ABS space-time. Can we probe the flat space structure of the ball? So we will explore that, and I'll try to give you a complete prescription to get the flat space limit out of CFT correlation function, the S matrix of the flat space theory from the CFT correlation function. And then at the end, I'll explore a particular regime of this kind of scattering experiments. A regime where we're probing higher scattering. And that's going to be useful to connect well-known properties of high energy scattering in gauge theories coming from Pomeran exchange, like this very famous well-known treatment of BFKL in the 70s. And here in the bulk side, we have high energy scattering is dominated by Bragdon exchange, so we'll be able to make this map. Okay, so let's start with point one. Okay, one. So here I'll be following really closely the paper, my last paper with Joe Kulczynski, Jamie Sully, and Itza Kinsker. Okay? So I didn't write down the reference, it's not fine at all, that's problem. Okay, so the basic idea that we want to understand here is this question. How can a field theory generate an extra dimension? Okay. So let me draw a basic picture that explains the problem. So if I take here my boundary theory, let's say let me now take a flat boundary, so it has to be dropped in the other boundary. And now I have here the bed with the radial arrows. Okay. Now suppose I consider two excitations in the ball, just separated in the radial arrow. So let me say I compute, I consider an excitation down here, far away from the boundary, an infrared excitation, and another one here, closer to the boundary, so more UV. From the boundary perspective, this excitation maps into some big infrared excitation in the boundary. And this one maps into a more UV, smaller excitation. Okay? But they are not separated in any way. I mean, from the field theory, why can't these two excitations interact directly? This looks like a miracle from the point of view of the field theory, that we have this separation. So the first thing you might say is, okay, this is just some notion of locality in the energy scale. The energy flow is also local in the local in the energy scale. So you could think that this just comes out from this fact. But that's not true. I mean, we know that the energy flow being local is not the full story. I mean, if you have really two excitations, in fact, there's some notion that if this one is very, very small, the interaction will decrease. So you have a very small dipole. Since these are color singlets, the interaction is proportional to the dipole. So the dipole of the excitation gets smaller and smaller, so the interaction gets weaker. But that's just some notion of what we call coarse holography. That just tells you that you have some locality in the energy scale. So let's try. That's what we call coarse holography. This means that you have locality in energy of order relative order one. Okay? There's no other parameter. It's just this idea that things interact strongly if they are not energy, but it's not a precise locality, not a sharp locality. So now if you just run through, so if you just go through the map that the energy scale is roughly the radial direction of the radius of ABS, and if you, the radial part of the metric is just dr squared over r squared, correct? You see that in terms of actual physical distance, this just means that you have a spatial resolution of order the radius of ABS. Okay? So this explains part of the locality, but doesn't explain locality in shorter scales than the radius of ABS. But the point is that we know that in n equals 4 or in super M wheels, that's at large n, and strong coupling, the parameters that set the scale are both much smaller than L. So for example, L Planck is basically given by R over n to the 1/4. So it's at large n, it's really parametrically smaller than the radius of ABS. And also L string. Okay? L string is also so here, I think, it's lambda, right? It's suppressed by lambda. So again, much smaller than the radius of ABS. So here, this is what we call sharp holography. Okay? And this is what we want to understand. You have a resolution on the scale, let's say, L string. Okay? Much parametrically smaller than the radius. In fact, in this talk, I'm going to take L string to zero. I'm going to focus on the limiting theory when you really focus on that. Okay, so this is a more concretely, more specifically, the miracle we want to understand. How can this new parametrically smaller scale than what we expected from coarse holography in the energy scale emerge in the field here? So, first thing that we should do is to understand what this implies. I mean, it's very clear that if you have L Planck much smaller than R, that means that you have a weakly coupled hole here. Right? You have L Planck over R is your loop counting parameter in the hole. So this implies that you have a weakly coupled here. Okay, and also because you have a weakly coupled dual, you have a notion of single particle constraints. Okay, so first thing that sharp locality gives you. So if this property is true, then you have you're able to define these two properties. You have a weakly coupled theory, so you have a notion of single particle. You can count any of these things. Another implication of sharp locality is the fact that excited string states are very massive. So, on the set, dual operators on an excited string has a parametrically large dimension. So, let's say two excited strings. So, essentially, the mass goes like the constant square, like one over alpha prime. Just have an excitation that is probing just a flat space region, because the size of the excitation will be on screen and it's much smaller than R, so you can use this. And now, just by the usual relation between the mass of the strings and the dual operator, you know that delta is, for large masses, is essentially m times r. So you have this r over l string. So this is, again, your large parameter. Okay? This parameter that you can tune to be infinity. So there's these two properties implied. Weakly coupled bulk and huge gap in the spectrum. That you can take the operators of the excited strings away from the spectrum. So now the point is just to say, to conjecture that these two properties are in fact sufficient. But if you have these two, you go the other way. You also have sharp locality. Okay. So that's the statement we want to do. So we take this miracle property of sharp holography, that somehow an extra direction appears in things that are really local in one higher dimension, for a simpler property of the field theory. We say that if you have a CFT that gets a very large gap, that most operators become with parametrically large dimension, then you have a local. So let me write this conjecture in a more precise form. So NCFT that has okay. I'll use the language of the usual example. So usually in the standard example of gauge theories of N equals 4, you weakly coupled dual just means that you're doing large eddies, right? And single particle states are dual to single trace operators. Okay. So I'll use this language, although really more generically, this would be this is what I'm talking about proper.
Is there some restriction on how excited the strings are? Because if they're very, very excited, they'll start to get longer.
That's true, but that just tells you so this gives you a gap. First excitation is already parametrically large. Then if you excite a lot, then you start to feel like yes, things don't have exactly the same spectrum of flat space. but I mean, dimension doesn't go down.
No.
You just go, and you excite more, so you're more excited. So any CFT that has a Lagrangian expansion and in which all single trace operators okay, of spin greater than 2. So this is a clarification. What do I mean by almost all operators getting large dimension of spin greater than 2 have parametrically large dimension has a local. Okay, so again, this is more or less in the same reason. So if you have some light field which spin greater than 2, then you essentially we don't know how to write a consistent field theory, gravity theory for that matter, in the ball. Right? If you have I'm going to talk about that a bit. So you can have higher spin fields, but then you need to have all of them. You cannot just stop at some spin greater than 2. So okay, we also conjecture that that's really the basic property, that you get all operators that have spin greater than 2 have to get parameters of life. So, yeah. It's for what we know now, it's a necessary condition, and we claim it.
Sorry, but so for any CFT, what do you mean by mass M?
I mean, there has to be a parameter that is small that makes the dual.
Right. So without that, you just have the single trace operator with spin. I mean, the rest of the sentence says you have a bulk deal. All right, and then it's a
no. Sorry. No, because you also have. Okay, you can. I think in this example that I'm going to tell you now.
Because otherwise, this sentence reads kind of cyclic. You're saying there is a weak.
That's true. I know what you mean. But you can define the. That's what I want to explain right now.
Okay.
You can define the large n limit. The fact that you have a large n expansion in terms of CFT, in the CFT, just means that connected correlators are suppressed relative to disconnected ones. Okay? So you have. Let me just give you this example. So consider the your Wang model. Okay, in 3 dimensions. O-N model in 3 dimensions. So this is basically just the infrared fixed point of this action. You have some vector field, A goes from 1 to N, and then you have some partial interaction, which is relevant in 3D, and so you run some infrared fixed point. Okay? So in this theory, you have a notion of, okay, it's not here that no traces, it's a vector theory, but you have a notion of single trace or single particle operator. So basically, you can define current operator, which are essentially, you take this field by I, and you take the derivative. Okay, you can do like this, you get the primary operator minus the trace. this is a primary of string L. And now if you take correlation function of these J's, J of X1, J of Fn, the connected correlation functions, they decay. So essentially they go like n minus root of n over 2. N is the number of so this statement, so this large n gives you a weakly coupled ball. But you don't satisfy the other properties of this model. So there are no extra parameters, so the dimensions of this single trace of the single partial operator are essentially 2 plus L, the classical dimension, plus a normal dimension of order 1 over n. And here there's no extra parameter. I mean, spin, there's only n that suppresses what I'm just saying. There's no parameter that makes this anomaly like there's no lambda in this theory. So this theory is dual to a weakly coupled ball theory, but if you want highly streaming. So in fact, we know, or so Klebanov and Polyakov proposed that this theory is dual to a higher spin theory in AES4. So it's a theory with fields of all spins, of all even spins. This is only for even spins. This is zero for all spins. But you have vertices with unbounded number of derivatives. So it's a non-local theory. It's a non-local theory. At least in the strict sense that we Okay, so now what I want to do.
Just for the heck of it, can you clarify spin greater than 2? What I'm thinking is if I have a bulk ADS, some large number of dimensions, I can imagine having anti-symmetric tensors propagating around in there with many indices. And so I'm not sure what you mean by spin 2. I mean, I would want to categorize it by Young tableau or something.
Right, I see. That's true. But the symmetric representation, right? That's the total spin.
So it's something about the symmetric representation.
Yes. Yeah. You're right, yes. Because, we know with forms, with higher forms, we know that that's possible. Right. True. So now what I want to do is to see how this works in a very simple example. Okay? So maybe I should write it over there. So first of all, let me just tell you. So now this is the statement. You have a consistent CFT if it has these two properties of some parameter that makes correlators decay, the connected correlators disappear, and a large gap in the dimensions, the only solution should be the same as the local ball tool. Okay? So what are the constraints we have? We have these two that I just said, and then we have just constraints from the consistency of the CFT. Okay? So the first one is, of course, conformal invariance. The second one is the OP. Okay? You want to have an ISOP, an isooperator product expansion. So, right, in particular, so let me just try it. Suppose you have a Y, a J, 0, and you have an OP, you have some sum over k, ci, j, k, ok, 0, let me write, also price indices, so essentially delta k minus delta I minus delta j, ok, 0, and ok, you have plus this sentence. But all this is fixed by conformal dimension, by conformal invariance, and all you just need these numbers. Right? So now you see. So in the conformal theory, the OPE inside the correlation function has a finite radius of convergence. So the radius of convergence is essentially the closest point, the other closest point. So since it has a finite radius of convergence, if you know all these CIJKs, you know all the theories. Moreover, in the regime we are considering, when delta k goes to infinity, so operators that appear here that are of this type that have a parametrically large dimension, they drop out from the OPE, because if you're inside the radius of convergence, they just drop out. You have x over x radius of convergence, and you see they are suppressed by delta k. So what we want to do is to look at this limiting theory with a closed OPE only between the low dimension operators, okay? So that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at the limiting theory just with the low dimension operators. So writing too big. So the next property is crossing. Crossing symmetry. So this is just saying that you can use OPE in different channels, right? If you have a four-point function, you can choose to take OPE between 1 and 2 or between 1 and 3. So that gives you, let me write, if you have a four-point function, you can write it in using your V, say it's between 1 and 3. I'll write it like this. So 1 and 3. Then you have k going here, and you have 2 and 4. Okay? But you could also use, sorry, and of course, you have the 1, 2k, sorry, 1, 3k, 2, 4k, right? This couplings at these cubic vertices. So here, let's say, for example, this channel, 1, 2, 3, 4, k here. So you have C1, 2k, C3, 4k. Okay? So this is a very constraining property on the possible CIJKs, on the possible OPE partitions. I totally forgot to put this. That's a pity. Okay. I should do it now at least. Okay, so these are essentially the basic, this is basically the property that we're going to use. You could think that we also have, let me write it here because I'm not going to use it, but in principle we also have unitarity. But here unitarity is not going to be that useful because you're going to solve in the large n expansion, so you have a leading term, like the order zero term from the disconnected graphs, which will be unitary by itself, so it will have, I mean, the spectrum will satisfy unitary constraints. And this expansion coefficient here will be positive. So another unitarity consequence is that since this is like a square, when, for example, when the operators are all the same, this is a square of a real number, so this needs to be positive. That will be, in our case, it will be explicitly positive, the zero order term. And then the correction can have either sign because it's small. So unitarity won't play a big role in constraining this problem. And you could also ask about modular invariance. So again, modular invariance here won't be very useful. Because, so in G equals 2, modular invariance just usually relates the low dimension operators with the high dimension operators, right? Like in the Cardiff formula,
if you know the lowest state, you know that the density of states very high dynamic. So here you're looking at the limiting theory. So modular invariance doesn't act, doesn't the action of modular invariance is not closed in the limiting theory. And moreover, there's a more concrete problem is that we really only understand modular invariance in two dimensions. So we want to do generic dynamics. So we won't use that. Okay, so we know the statement of the problem. Let's then choose a simple model and see how it works. Okay. So I'm going to choose the simplest possible model you can imagine. I'm going to choose a CFT with only one operator, one scalar primary operator. Okay, so let's study our scalar toy model. Only one scalar. Oh. Of dimension L. And I'm waiting for complaints, but no one complained. Thank you.
So that's an obvious problem in this
model. It's too simple. So you should think of it, if you want, like the conservative approach is to think of it as a sect of a couple of model theory. So in fact, in the end, we will add the energy momentum tensor, and in terms of understanding the and it will work anyway. I will show you that. I will put it in at the end. But the main point is that essentially you have to the constraints are very similar if you just work with scalars or with the energy momentum tensor. Just the complexity conceptually they are similar. Another way to see it is that we're going to have to impose crossing. And so if you have, say, graphs, scalar interactions in AVS that solve crossing, and then you also have graphs, and you also have graphs in AVS where you exchange gravitons, for example, so that you really have a full gravitational theory, those graphs will solve crossing independently, separately. So you have, like, graviton exchange in the several channels will solve crossing, and the other scalar interactions will solve crossing by itself. So that it's also enough to look at this sector. So this is our spectrum, and now we're gonna the OPE that we have. If you have O with O, you can have the identity operator in the OPE. In principle, you could also have O itself. And then you can have, sorry, I should say here.
This is the gravity
tunnel
decoupled from the scale.
I didn't say decoupled. I mean, I said, you say it, yeah. I mean, crossing is just this fact that essentially you have this invariance when you interchange the points. And if you have a sum of written diagrams with graviton exchange in the several channels, that is obviously symmetric under this exchange.
In the K, that everything will run.
Sorry?
In the middle there, K will run
over everything. Importantly, over the graph.
What I'm saying is that you will have a sum over Ks, which are operators that I'm going to discuss now. And then if you want to include graviton, K would also include the energy momentum tensor. I'm saying that those two, you can like split the sum, and those two sums will solve crossingly independently. What I'm saying is that trivial. You take a Witten diagram and you compute Witten diagrams with scalar interactions, all possible channels. That's obviously invariant under the permutation of the forms. With gravitons, it's the same thing. You don't need to. The symmetry under the interchange of the external points applies to the two sets of graphs in the same. So let me. Of course. Sorry, I forgot to say the important word. Single trace, right? Only one elementary field in ADS. Of course, you can have multi-particle states in ADS, which so you also have to allow multi-trace operators. So in particular, in UPE, it's going to be important to study double trace operators. So I'm going to label them by N and L. And these double trace operators are just, let me write this, are just, you take two operators, and then you take derivatives between the operators. And you can also take del square to the n minus 3. Okay? This is your
double trace operators. They are dual to two particle states in the ball. And they appear in GOP. So for now, we'll do a further simplification. We'll remove it at the end, which is to say that we have some, so O is odd under a Z2 symmetry, so this guy won't be allowed. Okay? We have some Z2 symmetry that forbids this guy appearing in the operator of O with itself. So the OPE of our single trace operator will just give the identity or double trace operator. Okay, you can also have more stuff, but that like higher trace operators, but that will not contribute to the four-point function that we will study the crossing relation. Good. So now let me just write. So for example, the dimension of this double trace operator will just be the dimension of the two single trace plus the number of derivatives plus an anomalous part. And again, this is where the large n expansion enters. You have an anomalous dimension which is suppressed by this parameter n squared. Okay, I'll use this language n, but you see here, this is really generically, n doesn't have any meaning as a trace or something. It's just you have a parameter that controls the expansion of anomalous dimension. You have the energy of the two particle state is almost the energy, the sum of the energy of the single part plus a small anomalous part. Okay. So now, now let's write this equation. Specifically for this model. So let's define. Let's consider the four-point function. Okay. So just by conformal invariance, so the four-point function is essentially fixed as a form that is fixed, which I can choose to write like this. And up to an unknown function of the cross ratio. So let me define the cross ratios for you. So I'll call one cross ratio this product Z times Z bar. So do I have to find it? And the other cross ratio I call one minus 1 minus z times 1 minus z. So this is a convenient choice because like this, the OPE limits of the points coming together correspond either to z going to 0, z going to 1, or z going to infinity. So you have the usual analytic structure of the four-point function, the three singular point, the three OPE limits at 0, 1, and infinity. So now the first thing, crossing, you can just say crossing comes just from the symmetry when you interchange points. So essentially, it's the symmetry when you interchange point one and two. If you do this game, you just get a of z bar over z bar to the delta is equal to a of 1 minus z, 1 minus z bar over 1 minus z, 1 minus z bar to the delta.
You, 1 over n squared? It's just a parameter. It's a small parameter. I could call it lambda. It's just a small parameter that was in the prerequisites of our conjecture. Right? We have a consistency of t with a small parameter that suppresses that means that you have a weakly coupled bolt. It suppresses the dimension of single trace. So the leading order dimension of a double trace is just the sum of the dimensions of the single trace plus a small correction. So this is just a parameter, a small parameter that we said that we have to have a sharp look on, sharp over.
So if you say just 1 over n is just a parameter, then when you talk about single trace and double trace operators, they are also
single part of double and double. And
okay, so some, but in terms of CFT, just class of operators.
Hey, it's a class of operators that that you can identify by taking correlation functions, and you see that those operators, when you put one more in the correlation function and you take the connected correlator, it decays. It's again suppressed by this parameter as a class of operators.
So the CFT doesn't have to be based on matrix.
No, I mean, I just gave the example before that already obeyed this property and was a theory of context. So then it failed the second property, the gap. Good, so
we already have one equation. This will be one equation. The symmetry of the four-point function, and the second equation is just a partial wave expansion that comes from the OPE. Now you can just choose one channel and say that you have that expansion. So let me write. So a of z bar. So from the OPE you read, you have the identity and then the double trace. So the identity in this notation essentially gives a one, contribution one, plus, and here you just have the sum of the double trace. N and L with some coefficients, let me call it P. And then the partial wave, the conformal block function. So the function, so these functions is the form of the four-point function you get when you that comes from the exchange of a single primary operator and its descendant. Okay, it's a conformal block function. So, in fact, I I wrote it explicitly before because I wanted you to have a notion of the complexity involved in these functions. So in the case that we studied, which is two dimensions and four dimensions, these functions are explicitly given by this combination of hypergeometric functions. So they are relative, they are explicit. Okay? So that, I mean, this, it won't be important to follow what I want to tell you, but it's important that we only have explicit expressions like this in even dimension. For example, if you want to do d equals 3, our methods, the way we did it, we don't know, it doesn't work because we don't have, we just have some more complicated integral representation. So we, right now we're trying to think of doing this this exercise in a different way using directly the integral representation to see if we can do really generic dimension. Okay, I think I'll getting late, so I won't write this equation. So let me then write, I think you can understand next equation. So there's we still need to do one thing to actually get the problem completely defined. So we still need to expand in 1/n. Okay? Here this is the exact formula, but of course we have this parameter and we only want to solve this problem to leading order in this small parameter. So
sorry, I'm looking that I thought that this N and L parameterize the descendant.
No, not this. These are primary operators. They are double trace primary operators. These are primary operators. In fact, because these operators are the same, this is you only have L even. Okay? L is zero, you don't have a
part. Sorry, can I ask?
Sure.
If you consider another contraction, O1 and O4, it doesn't give you an independent relation.
No. So in this case, if you consider the other contraction, essentially just tells you that L is even. So there's one of the crossing relations just tells you that L is even because these functions, these partial wave functions, have a property that when you say like that, there's a transformation when z goes to z over z minus one, which is one of the channels that you're saying. They just change by minus one to the L. So the fact that they are the same just tells that L has to be that there's no additional constraint for the even part.
So as I was saying, now the last step that we need to do is to expand this in 1/n. So these coefficients will be, all right, so it will be some P0 plus 1/n² P1, okay? And A will also be A0 plus 1/n² A1, okay? So A0 is just the disconnected part. It's just, A0 is just you contract the operators like this, plus you contract the operators like this, plus you contract the operators like this. Okay, so this you know explicitly. With this, you compute P0, and then you just have an equation for A1 and P1. Okay, let me just write that equation so that we can have the problem completely written down. So the best way to write it now is like this. okay, this is our tree. So essentially, I just expand that. So I take the order 1 over n squared in that equation. You see this, because of the anomalous dimensions, you have to take a derivative of the partial wave with respect to dimension of the exchanged operator. So that's this derivative. I write it as a derivative with respect to n. But here, n is really just a parameter that appears in the partial wave, so I can write it as a derivative with respect to n. And then the last equation is just the symmetry that we had before, that z goes to 1 minus z, OK? That box equation. So this is our equation.
And P0 is given.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. P0 is over there, some gamma functions. It's some exercise that you have to do. You have to take this A0, which is a product of two-point functions, and expand it in partial waves. So the order 0, you know we're splitting this left-hand side. You just have to expand the function in these hypergeometric functions, and that comes up. Okay. It's an exercise you have to do in mathematics.
Is one of the best products you're expanding is not the same end as twice the other place?
It is, of course.
Why don't we include it?
No, I include it. I mean, this term, appears precisely because of that.
Oh, so this is not the conformal, it's just the conformal block statement.
Sorry? This is a conformal block function, but here inside the dimension of the conformal block, there's a dimension, there's an anomalous dimension. This delta of n and l is given there. So you have to expand here, and that means you have to take this derivative with respect to energy, with respect to dimension of the partial wave, and you get this term. Let me repeat. This is okay, right? Exact thing. Expanding partial waves, identity double trace. Okay.
Oh, identity double trace. Okay, so I okay, so then.
Well, this is double trace, n and l.
This is my previous question, I thought that's a lot more.
Okay. Is it clear now? Good. So now let's think of it.
We have applied all the constraints to this model. We have assumed we have used the assumptions that you have a large N expansion and a big gap. So you only have this one single trace operator. And now you have this equation that has two unknowns. Okay? The unknowns here, use this color. These are the unknowns. Okay? This and this. So the correction to these partial wave coefficients and the anomalous dimension. These are the end. And you have an equation that is valid for any z and z bar. Okay? So you have unknowns labeled by two integers, n and l. And you have an equation with two real variables. So you can think that if you expand in a basis, you also have a set of equations labeled by two integers. So you just this naive counting tells you that you have more or less the same number of equations and the same number than the number of unknowns. So I don't know. If you look at this like this, it's not very easy to know what you're going to do with this equation. So what we need to do is to use our Bolt intuition. So we already know many solutions to this equation. Okay, what are these solutions? If you take the four-point function to be given by any Witten diagram with some quartic interaction, let's say you take just a pure 5-4 interaction in the bulk, and you compute this 4-point function. This will solve this equation. If, I mean, the coupling constant here being 1 over n squared. Okay? this will solve this equation because it has all the properties. The only operators that appear in the OP are this, are the double traces, these two particle states of when it, of this external operator. Okay. So now, from the bulk, you already know many solutions because any quartic interaction. So you can take, say, phi 4, but you can also take phi square and then del mu phi square. You can decorate your quartic vertex with derivatives. Okay, and the list goes on forever, right? You can put more and more. For example, like this. This is just a particular sequence you can separate around. So from the bulk, you already know that you will have infinite solutions to this equation. Okay, so that's a bit of a problem because we wanted to show that this equation only has solutions that can be interpreted as local bulk interaction, okay? As coming from a local bulk theory. So now we have to find this map between this infinite number of solutions. So, but there's a way out. So what we have to do, what we decided to do, was to put an extra condition that makes the solutions finite. So let me, I should draw this picture. I don't need this anymore. So what we're going to do is to say, so notice here we have to count quartic interactions in the bulk up to total derivatives, right? That just gives you the same four-point function if this is a total derivative, and also up to the equations of motion, right? You can, if you have del square acting on phi, you can replace that by the mass because this is just a three-level diagram. So that's exactly equivalent to counting S matrix elements in flat space coming from this interaction. So this is, I say, this is the vertex. And so this is the S matrix. Okay, so if you just have phi 4, the S matrix is 1, right? There's nothing there. If you have, like, for example, here two derivatives acting on phi, you just measure, so say phi 1 and phi at point 1 and 2, you measure the moment and you contract. So you get like S squared, for example. But then since you have to, phi is only, I mean, you only have one field, you have to take the weak contraction. So this gives you the symmetric S squared, T squared, U squared. And it goes on like that. So in this case would be like S3L plus T3L. But I mean, this is not the only, you can have more combinations. The idea is that you just have to count symmetric polynomials of S, T, and U with the extra condition that S plus T plus U is zero. Okay? So the on shell condition. Zero or, okay, it's equivalent, or zero or 4n squared. In fact, here, you can just count it zero. This is so that's just some combinatorics. I don't want to do that here, because I'm getting really late, but I just want to draw a picture. So now we're going to count these derivatives and label them by two things. One is the number of derivatives that you have in the quartic vertex. So it's, if you want the order of the polynomial, in fact, you can divide by two because the because you have to contract, so you have always even derivatives. And another thing is the maximal spin in the partial wave expansion of this interaction. Okay. So that's easier to think here. So you have a polynomial, an S matrix which is a polynomial. So it can be expanded in partial waves in flat space with finite spin, right? The degree, the partial waves, so let's say, that depends on, okay, And partial layer are just Legendre polynomials of, say, minus t over s, okay? Sine squared theta, or cosine theta, it depends on how you want to write. So it's really just counting, rewriting the polynomials in a different way. So we're going to organize the interactions in terms of their number of derivatives and their maximal spin, okay? And very quickly. Okay, you kind of see the pattern. Okay, this is 0, 1, 2, and this is 0, 1, 2. Okay, so it organizes in some nice way. It's just when you go up in spin, you only have even spins, and with maximal spin 2, you have 2 interactions. Maximal spin 4, you have 3. Maximal spin 6, you have 4. Okay, it's always like that. So the point is that now we're gonna say that we only allow solutions with a maximal spin capital L. Okay. So we're gonna bound this and say we only allow this spin smaller or equal than capital L. And then the number of interactions that are below this thing is just, I mean, this counting problem is L plus 2, L plus 4 over 8. Okay? It's some combinatorics of this interaction. But this is very useful because now you have a finite number of solutions. Okay, you just have this solution with maximal spin L. So what we're going to do now is to say, let's bound this sum over L up to capital L, and count how many solutions there are here. Okay, and see if we really get a finite number and the same number.
What?
Did you cut it by some?
So I'm going to look for solutions of this equation which have bounded spin to L.
Can you just choose?
I choose that, yeah. Awesome.
Doesn't it make any sense from the CFT? I mean, restricting the operators or?
It restricts the coefficients here, so the coefficients for L bigger than capital L have to be 0.
Why can't you have a CFT with all of these contributes and therefore the local theory? And the dual theory would not be local because you have to have all of these.
We'll come back to that. Let me just go, ask me again. I'll talk about the embodied spin in a moment. So now,
because this now gets a bit. Okay, I think, yeah, this is quite technical anyway. So the idea is that now you want to solve this equation with this bounded L, okay? And there's essentially what you have to do, or at least that's the way we were able to do it, is to, so you have Z and Z bar. So you can think of this as a, so it's a, each of them, it's an independent parameter. You can do analytic continuation in Z and Z bar independently, okay? Because, I mean, they are only complex conjugates in the Euclidean theory. You really can move them independently in general. So the idea, the first thing you should do is to, that simplifies this equation, is to look at the limit, z going at a mixed limit. So you take z to 0 and z bar to 1. Okay? It's more symmetric, and it's this mixed limit. And now, so this function g, or this part, this block here, g over z z bar to delta, has a regular Taylor expansion around 0. Okay? It's really integer powers of z and z bar around 0. But this term takes a derivative with respect to this exponent. So this term introduces logs. So you distinguish these terms and these terms in this expansion. So these terms come with regular coefficients of z, and these terms come with logs. And now if you take this crossed limit, like z to 0 and z bar to 1, you can just, and you just focus on terms which are log z times log 1 minus z bar, you can just focus on the gamma. So the p1s do not contribute to this term. So you can reduce this equation to an equation which is just a recursion equation for the anomalous dimension. No, why? Okay, so again, these are the unknowns, gamma and gamma. This function j is explicitly known. It's some control integral of hypergeometric functions, but we know this function. Okay, so you have, this is like a recursion equation for this gamma. So the idea is that you can use these equations to solve some of the gammas as a function of the other. So again, if you plot the gammas as a function of n and let's say L over 2, because the spin is even, so you have gammas at all points, okay, and the spin is bounded, so let's say L. So now what you can do is to use these equations to solve. To write this gamma, say, as a function of all these gammas up to L. And then you can use another equation to solve for these two gammas in terms of all these white ones plus these two. And it goes on like this. Okay? So you lower the diagonal. These ones are determined, and these ones are free parameters. So, and again, now you see, you know that you have at most, the number of independent solutions is at most the number of free parameters. It's in fact not clear if it's exactly that, because you have many more equations that look over-constraining. But at most, you have this. And again, this is, if you count, it's precisely the same value. So what we were able to do was really just to say that from these equations, just by solving some of the gamma in terms of the others, we can bound the number of solutions to be this number. And then from the bulk, we know that at least we have this number of solutions. Okay? So, I mean, since they are the same, there's only really this number of solutions.
you are comparing the number of constraints and the number of solutions, and in order to, the library is just an infinite.
Yeah.
Okay. Once you introduce the cutoff, you
get. And let me also tell you that now you can go back. After you fix the gammas, you can go back and determine the other end on the P1s. The P1s are completely determined in terms of the gammas. So if you, it's just they are determined by the derivative of the zero times gamma. So there are no more solutions for the P1s. They are totally determined on the gammas.
So now let's go back to your question. Unbounded spin. So I don't know if that's what you meant, but one way to have this worry is to say, did we miss any solutions by bounding L? In other words, are there solutions to this crossing equation that cannot be written as a linear combination of these solutions with bounded L? And the answer is no, because we from the crossing equation, the original one, we can show that that the gammas at fixed n, they decay faster than any power of k. So this goes to zero for any k. Okay. When L is fixed. So you're able to get this property. And moreover, since you know the explicit form of the J's, that property tells you that you can really use this expansion, this recursion equation, when you put here infinity. So really the solutions can be found just from this recursion equation.
All of this, in what sense your marketing is not?
Good. So now let's do that for a second. So let's consider, for example, sum over k up to infinity and some interaction phi square, a square, del square acting on phi square. Okay? Sorry, okay. So this infinite sum of the rate. That, I mean, in fact, this is just simulating a propagating part, right? This is just phi squared 1 minus a squared dot squared, right? So this is simulating an exchange graph in AES. Right? So this would be better. This would mean that if this is a solution, then you're finding solutions which in the world correspond to propagating particles that you didn't have expected. But this is not a solution, because if you consider the gammas, all the gammas from each k, and now you sum over k, this diverges badly, okay? This is really, this infinite. I mean, this is not a solution. It doesn't have finite anomalous dimensions. If you want to recover something like this, you have to put explicitly a new partial wave in your problem from the start. You cannot simulate it like this. Are you happy, Amit?
It's much more. But still
good. We comment on that. So in fact, if you put here some
one of our cases.
Decays, some coefficient that decays very, very quickly. That's true, but the coefficient here is really to decay very fast. So in fact, it's like dk times k factorial square has to decay faster than any power of k. So it's really a really fast decay that gives a convergence here. So now I have dk. So yeah, this I don't know exactly what this means. There was some old paper from the 60s by Jaffe that was considering some propagators also with infinite number of derivatives, and if it decays fast enough, there was some notion of generalized locality that you could use. But yeah, this is something that we don't understand very well what it means to have something that has infinite number of derivatives, but the coefficients decay so fast that in some generalized sense it's still local. It's not, this derivative cannot shift you away any finite amount. It decays so fast, not an exponential of the derivative. Good. Now let me talk about including the energy momentum tensor. Okay. So what happens
over there? So we're using our intuition about the, you know, the bulk theory there. And Jaume is asking me a question here. I think the question is, you know, in the bulk theory, I'd expect loop corrections. And so when you cut something off, to what extent, you know, is that radiatively stable, or is that somehow taken into account all?
No, but this is exact. I mean, each one of these vertex, each one of these interactions is really exactly bounded spin. So for example, so here I just show you the counting, but we also did explicit partial wave expansion for these simple interactions like pure phi 4. So pure phi 4, I have a partial wave expansion with only spin zero coefficients. This quartic coupling without derivatives doesn't couple the two particle states. The, if you want, gives a zero three-point function between a double trace operator of spin greater than zero and two single traces. Did you see? I mean, just because, I mean, this is really 5-4. So the two particles only interact when they are on top of each other. So they can only change the dimension, the energy of a state of spin zero. Right? If to have spin, you have to split the particles. So that's an angular momentum. So that's in fact, the spin is always bounded by the number of derivatives. For a given quartic interaction with k derivatives, you can only have spin. Okay. Okay. So this I can just say in words because it's conceptually very simple.
So suppose now we drop the Z2 symmetry. So we allow for O in the OP. There's a new term in the OP. Because there's a new term in the OP, in the partial wave expansion, you have a new conformal block function. So we have an extra term here. You have this sum over the double traces plus an extra term corresponding to the partial wave of the single trace being a check. Okay. So you have one more unknown, this three-point function between single trace, single trace, single trace. So essentially, you can think of this new equation, of this new term, as being an inhomogeneous term in the equation for P1 and gamma. Okay, so you had this equation, now you had an extra term. So it's the same equation now with an inhomogeneous term. So what you have to do is just to find a particular solution. But that's very easy, because a particular solution that includes the single trace being exchanged is just, you can just take the ADS graph, the Witten diagram, where you exchange the scalar operator. So you take where you have the four O's and the same dual operator phi dual to O being exchanged. Okay? So this is a particular solution to the inhomogeneous equation. And now having the particular solution, you can always sum a solution to the homogeneous equation. But that's what we've been doing, counting solutions of the homogeneous equation. So the number of solutions will be just one more from this guy, which comes with an unknown parameter, this three-point coupling in the ball. And that precisely matches the three-point coupling of the three-point function in the boundary theory. So counting works very in the same way. You have a new parameter in CFT and a new parameter in the bulk. Okay. And you see, this argument goes through if now I also allow for graviton exchange. Instead of exchanging the scalar, I exchange graviton. So I'm considering a completely full gravity theory. Again, you're exchanging graviton, so you have energy momentum tensor being the OBE. You have a new partial wave function corresponding to the exchange of the energy momentum tensor. You have a new parameter, the coupling of the operator to the energy momentum tensor. And that's, again, the same parameter that couples here, O to the graviton. So counting works the same way. Really, the difficult part of counting was what we did, the homogeneous equation. Good. So
I think I said all that I wanted to say about point number one. So let me just summarize. So we have this sharp locality, this property, very strange, that the bulk theory, so that you have special CFTs that generate an extra dimension that are dual
to a theory in one R dimension, which is local in this one R dimension. So what we did, we conjectured that this strange property is a direct consequence of the large gap in the spectrum. So if the CFT, so in other words, if you can prove that the spectrum of n equals 4 super M nil actually has this property, I know if Pedro can get just from, can prove that the field theory implies a Y system and that the Y system implies that part, I think it's easy to prove, the R part derives the Y system just with the field theory. Okay, if you can do that, and you get directly this property of n equals 4, that at strong coupling, most operators get a very large anomalous dimension, then holography is a direct consequence of that. That's what we're saying. It's a, you have a simpler property implying this sharp holography. So another thing that I want to say is that this is also useful in these phenomenological approaches to condensed matter systems. Because you see here, we never use string embedding or string or any decoupling limit to recover the SCFT. You just have this idea that if by, for some reason in your CFT you're allowed to only study a subset of your operators, a small set of your primary operators, if that encodes the main dynamics of the problem, then the bulk theory is just an explicit realization that gives you a consistent CFT with that spectrum, okay? So I think it's good to motivate. Yes.
Yeah. Just play with it in the radial direction. Don't see why this necessarily increases speed.
Ah, you mean spin between spin in 5 dimensions and spin in 4 dimensions? I see. Yeah, no, but it works. I mean, it's really, if you do, for example, this guy explicitly, or we did this and this explicitly, and you really get exactly the expansion just in those spins. So, okay, it's really, I'm running out of time, so let me just list some interesting open questions that I think are worth pursuing. So, one thing that we are doing now
is try to understand better the exchange state more explicitly. So counting, as I just explained, is an easy, we have an easy argument for the counting to work. But to actually get explicit solutions, it's much more difficult. Because in that crossing equation, I mean, it really changes. When you have exchanges, the new partial wave has a new analytic structure, a new branch cut completely different from this one. These ones are double traced, so they are just separated by integers. But the other one is completely different. So you have to generate a new analytic structure from the sum. So it's technically much more complicated. We're trying to understand that. another thing I already said, it's the generic dimension. Okay, we want to understand this. This was very. We are very bounded by this fact that we know the explicit form of the conformal partial waves. This should, I mean, the same thing should be true in three dimensions in any event. So we're trying to develop methods that go use directly the integral representation of the partial waves and give the same result. Another more interesting thing is to go to higher orders in 1 over n squared. So I think this is in fact related with Amit's worry, with infinite sum. Because in what I told you, there was no qualitative distinction between having both renormalizable interaction and the both non-renormalizable interaction. I just added derivatives, so I have these new vertices with many derivatives, which are badly non-renormalizable in the both, and they are still solutions. There's no, we don't see a clear picture. So one idea would be to understand if you go to the next order, where in the both you're doing one loop, understand what's the problem in the CFT. Some should start to diverge because you're taking a non-renormalizable interaction. So that's something we would like to understand precisely. How does the normalizability in the both affect the CFT? Another thing which would be interesting would be to study something like pure gravity. So really just scattering of gravitons. That's the only problem with that is that it's really technically more difficult because you have to consider four-point functions of energy momentum tensors of spin two fields. So the conformal block functions become much more complicated with the index structure. But I mean, conceptually again, should be a similar thing. Another thing that I think this problem is one of the problems that you have much more conceptual understanding than technical control. So it's clear that we know lots of examples without conformal symmetry that still work, they still have a nice holographic dual. So conformal symmetry is not the fundamental property that is doing the job. It should be possible to do a similar analysis in a field theory that is not conformal. So yeah, that I really don't know. I mean, you have many more variables, the problem would be much more unconstrained, and you have more equations. I don't know, but I think it would be good to understand that point. Okay, and finally, just to comment, another thing that Joe was particularly excited was trying to think on this, using this to study the sitter CFT correspondence. So usually the problem to studying the SCFT is that you cannot derive that from a string theory embedding, so as a decoupling limit of string theory. So here, since we never used that, maybe we could try to run the same type of arguments now with the sitter and with this space-like boundary at infinity, and try to understand what does it mean for this boundary at infinity, to be dual to an expanding universe. You will have CFTs with imaginary dimensions. You have these problems with analytic continuation, but that might be an interesting avenue to study. Okay, since it's without time, I think I'll finish. Thank you.
Maybe it's better to postpone questions since we have a colloquium in afternoon.
Sure.
Thank you.